Welcome to Tribe Podcast Episode 2, where our mission is to normalize mental health by creating an open narrative for our people's protectors, one conversation at a time. 22 veterans die by suicide every day. We hope to help turn the tide by giving an inside look at the psychological rigors of a career as one of our nation's protectors and act as a platform for medical professionals to speak about their approaches to curb PTSD, TBI, and depression. Today we're joined by Tribe founder and co-host Gunner Joey Petrico. We'll continue our conversation from episode 1 as we dive into his career after his time at Marine Special Operations Command, where he completed 4 combat deployments and rose to the highest levels of the enlisted chain of command. Upon his departure from Special Operations, Petrico continued to break barriers within the Marine Corps infantry community as a Marine gunner. On today's episode, we'll take an inside look into the mental toll of elite military service over a prolonged period through the lens of Gunner Joey Petrico. Gunner, good to see you again.
Yeah, you too, man. I appreciate it. And just want everyone to know that we are going to dedicate this podcast to Gunnery Sergeant Rob Safford, who tragically died on 22 March 2023 and leaves behind his daughter, Bella.
Our thoughts are and prayers are with his family, and of course, whatever we can do to support Bella. I know there's a GoFundMe going around. Whatever we can do to help out, I think the MARSOC community, it sounds like, is definitely rallying behind Bella, and we hope that her the best.
Yeah, especially because she lost her mother too of cancer 6 months ago. So Rob is a single father battling some stuff. So yeah, any help that we could get.
Absolutely. So Gunner, last time we talked, we were wrapping up your time as the Special Operations Forces Senior Enlisted Advisor for the Raider Regiment Training and Education Group. Basically, you had completed all of your time in leadership positions on the enlisted chain of command at MARSOC, and you had created this position where you were creating doctrine for Special Operations units, and you were directly reporting to the regimental commander, who's a colonel at MARSOC. At which point you decided to leave Special Operations, move back to the infantry. Now, this is a big move for anyone in the infantry or MARSOC. They know how significant that move is. Can you talk about the differences between MARSOC and the infantry and kind of and explain as to why you wanted to make that move after rising to the highest levels of MARSOC?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the biggest thing for me, I knew going in it was going to be a culture shock. Especially being in Special Operations for so long, the different standards, still upholding the Marine Corps standard, but different standards, you're held higher, working with such a high caliber individual, and then going back to the infantry where it would have been like a different culture shock. But my want to be a gunner started when I was a baby Marine, first got to the infantry, and I saw this guy with this one shiny thing and a bomb on the other collar, and he spoke so intelligently of like weapons and infantry tactics. And this is when we first got to Iraq. It's the only first time I saw him, and I'm like, and he like captured the audience, and I was sucked in, and I'm like, man, I want to be that guy. And then as I continued my career, I was like, I found my niche of helping people and my passion for infantry tactics and making people better to survive in combat in the gunfight. So that's really where I built my career to end up being a gunner. Just my passion in helping out the guys with no voice who couldn't, had great ideas and were good at their job, but just were so low, they just didn't have a voice.
So what is a Marine gunner?
So a Marine gunner in the Marine Corps is a unicorn. Like I said, they wear one rank and a bursting bomb on the other collar. And usually when they come around, everyone listens. But what they are is the senior advisor to the commander on everything, weapons deployment-wise, infantry tactics, training, doctrine, and really there to support the lowest guy on the ground. He's the conduit between the officer ranks and the enlisted ranks, and really, is there to make the battalion, the unit, better as a whole, by bringing their experience, their knowledge, and everything to bear in the fight.
Right. So as a weapons and tactics specialist at an infantry battalion, which is, about 1,000 infantrymen, you are one of the few people who can transcend all ranks, right?
Yep.
You are the direct advisor to the battalion commander, who's a lieutenant colonel, with regards to weapons and tactics, live fire execution, training. But you're also a guy who can go to a range and speak to our most junior Marines, again, the 18, 19-year-old guys who are actually pulling the triggers,
yep.
and talk the most basics, you know, of the X's and O's out on the battlefield. So you are a guide in an infantry unit with a ton of influence on the culture of that unit, the execution proficiency, so on and so forth. And you are really a guy who's very well respected.
Yeah.
So coming from MARSOC, how many guys became Marine gunners?
I was the first one to become that was a badge holder that became a Marine gunner.
Okay. And let's dive into the process to become a Marine gunner, right? So just if you can explain, if you come from a regular infantry background versus a special operations background, what is the pipeline to become a gunner? How many guys do become gunners and whatnot?
Yeah, so for a regular infantry guy, there's certain wickets you need to hit. Either, you know, your instructor time, your unit leader time, your company gunny time, and then really just padding your resume within the infantry community and hitting all these different billets to become a gunner. And then you apply, which is a huge, huge package with letters of recommendations. And then you go up to Headquarters Marine Corps, where they board you. The board consists of 106, which is a full bird colonel, lieutenant colonels, and then two gunners who sit on the board. And they go through all these packages. Usually you're looking at, you know, 70 packages make it up to the boardroom to get briefed, and only X amount get selected. So on my board, I think 65 made it to the boardroom and 12 of us got selected. And that's pretty normal each year, depending on how many guys retire. That's how many they're going to select to fill those ranks back up. Now, for me, my career path was different. So I spent time in the infantry and then went to MARSOC Special Operations. So even though our billets, you know, platoon sergeant, team chief are similar in nature, the briefing style of, you know, a colonel or a lieutenant colonel hearing, you know, platoon sergeant versus team chief, without a special operations conduit there, they're like, what is a team chief? You know, what is this? How does this billet relate to a platoon sergeant? Or how does, you know, a company operations chief relate to a company gunny? Stuff like that. So it was, for me, I submitted three times to become a gunner, only to break the special operations regular infantry barrier of getting that across the goal line of them, of the members of the board trying to understand what my billets were. And background wise, I had all my instructor time, all the schools, everything. It's just, how did it relate back to the infantry community?
Okay. And did you get a lot of pushback as you were trying to leave MARSOC? Obviously you were a very valued guy over there with an incredible reputation and career path. Was it hard for them to let you go?
No, I think my command was extremely supportive of what I wanted and wanted to be a gunner. So for them breaking into the big Marine Corps, the service, I should say, and having a critical skills operator within an infantry battalion would help them narrate their narrative and give back to the Marine Corps as a whole. And, you know, it bridges the communication between the special operations community and the infantry. So it helped them, and it helps them overall, because I could speak intelligently to the masses on MARSOC. So yeah, the support from the command was always there, and always wanted me to go be a gunner and open that door for MARSOC.
Awesome. So number one, you'd be able to recruit for MARSOC, put a great name to a face at an infantry battalion, which is where a lot of guys who, you know, started in the Marine Corps as infantrymen with hopes to get to the varsity level of operations, and have questions about the MARSOC recruiting pipeline. That's where they all start. You'd be able to help those guys progress and prepare for assessment and selection. And number two, again, you are a subject matter expert. You've operated at the highest levels. You have a ton of combat experience. So you'd really be able to raise the level at an infantry battalion. Now, I like to think of, you know, MARSOC being like the NFL, right? I would consider the infantry to be maybe a D3 football team. Do you agree with that?
Me personally, no, right? Because that's where I said this in the last podcast, our first episode, that I truly believe that the infantry could be great. So how I look at the Marine Corps infantry is probably different than most. I'm sure some people have the same view, but I really think the Marine Corps infantry can be a true light infantry elite unit, similar, and I hate to use this analogy, is similar to the Rangers. Right, I really think if we put the effort into the infantrymen and the time and the investment, especially in their careers, that the Marine infantry could be great. And that's really was my driving factor of showing the younger guys that they are special, that, you know, they do have the ability to, you know, be an elite unit. They just have to put in the time and put in the effort.
Right. And I completely agree. But just in terms of, you know, general proficiency levels across the board, the funding, the types of guys that you have, you know, your average guy on a special operations team is, number one, several years older than your average infantryman. He's a lot more mature. He is better funded, better equipped, is offered many more avenues for training, and is overall a better warfighter. So, given that, you wanted to come in and be the guy to help bridge that gap, right? Yeah. Raise the level between our infantrymen, our 0311, which is their military occupational specialty code, and get him as high as possible for the next war.
Right. Yeah.
So, as you leave special operations, how many years into your career are you at that point?
I was at 17 years at that time.
Okay. And you apply to this board, right? You get boarded, so it's like an interview held by the colonel, correct?
Yeah, it's all paper based, so they go through your whole career, okay, all your letters of recommendation, and what you've done in your military background to make you qualified, and how you'll be an asset to the infantry.
Okay, and you get accepted.
I got accepted.
So at this point, you are preparing for a massive change in your life.
Huge change.
You are going from doing multiple combat deployments with an elite unit and now shifting to going to a school.
Yeah. So looking at warrant officer basic course, which was 4 months, similar to the basic course that you went to, obviously.
So yeah. So a 4-month course. It's a very, very basic infantry-based course with people from all over the Marine Corps, right? Not just infantrymen.
Right, yeah. Military occupation specialty across the board that's going to be a warrant officer or chief warrant officer.
So what's the purpose of that? Why do these people want to go to warrant officer basic course? What are they? What kind of jobs are they going to get into by way of this course in the Marine Corps?
So in the Marine Corps, I mean, any job field that has a warrant officer, a chief warrant officer. So looking at career recruiters, personnel officers, CBRN, EOD officers, counter intel officers, all the whole motor T officers, the whole gamut of people.
Right. So these Marines have been identified to become specialists,
yes,
in their field, right? Yep. Whether that is counterintelligence, motor transportation, so logistics, you know, so on and so forth, supply, whatnot.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So they take all of you guys, they send you to Quantico, and you do a 4-month course,
right,
which is basic infantry stuff.
Right.
Why do they send you all to Quantico?
So the goal is to make everybody, same as a second lieutenant, a provisional rifle platoon commander, and put us on the same playing field as a second lieutenant.
Okay. So just a basic officer in the Marine Corps.
Right.
So, again, you're leaving the most elite fighting unit that the Marine Corps has. Correct. You were with plenty of combat experience, and you were going to the most basic course, which you could have been to since, you know, boot camp.
Right, yeah.
Where's your head at, and what are you thinking?
Oh, yeah, so I think this is where mentally I started to crack. And going to this school, I knew I had to do it. I was super pumped to be a gunner, but once I got there, it was going back 16 years in my career. Now remember, I was at 17 years. I was learning things that I knew from when I was like a private first class, doing things I was doing. You know, throughout my career, I mean, even to the point of my schooling, of being more schooling than the instructors. So it was very difficult going from, you know, briefing up to a general level, like a general officer level, down to you're a private again at 17 years of time in service after doing all this stuff you said. So my mindset was, what did I get myself into? What am I doing here? And why am I doing this? And I just started to, at that point, go internal and get into my head really bad, to the point of the school wasn't the most rigorous I've ever been to, right? I've been through so much more in my career. Academically, it wasn't hard whatsoever. And I was performing at the lowest I've ever performed in my life.
So as an infantry guy, we talk about going internal all the time. What do you mean by that?
So going internal, going in the black is you are basically in your head, and everything gets to you. You're quiet and you're gone. You're like, your eyes are black. Your pupils are black and you can't make decisions. You're not doing things as you normally would do it.
So we use the Cooper's color code, right, to describe your state of being. The black being the worst, right? You're under the most duress. You are completely internally focused. You are stressed to a level in which you have no longer have rational thought.
Right.
You no longer can make decisions. And most importantly, you can no longer lead people.
Right.
So you find yourself in this state.
Yep.
Right. You were going through this course, which you are relearning stuff that is so basic that you can't imagine you're there. You're kind of questioning why you made this move.
Yeah.
And what do you think prompted all that? I mean, leaving combat deployments, having a significant purpose in your life, which was MARSOC, and then rising to the highest levels. What was it, just a massive drainage in having a why as to what you were doing?
I knew the why. It was just really going, like, why did I have to go to a school where I was away from my wife, away from my kids, and go through this, you know, school that was just beating me up even more than what I was already beat up. You got to remember, like, all the guys who are going to be gunners have, you know, time in service is like 16 years. Everybody else has like 10 years time in service, 9 years time in service. Like, they're way junior than us. And now we're going from an operational, you know, unit to a school, not at our home base, away from our families. And, you know, just the rigors of going backwards in my career, or what I thought was, and then being away from, you know, my wife, Summer, my kids, that took a toll as well. And then just, you know, it was just like a grind, like a really, really rough grind.
So you find yourself towards the bottom of your class.
Yep.
You're seemingly messing stuff up academically, which you are an undoubted expert in.
Yep.
Right? And it's just this... It is, you know, the product of being in such an elite unit and then going down to such a basic level.
Yeah, I was mentally drained. And, my care factor wasn't there. Like, I start to lose my passion for the job.
So, as you interacted with instructors and your grades came out, and they, you know, obviously started asking, what's wrong?
Yeah.
What were those conversations like?
I mean, I was honest. I was like, I don't understand. Like, you know, I'm playing the game, right? And I hate to say playing the game, but I was playing the game, and I'm just like, you know, I told him straight. It's like, I am beyond this. Like, I'm beyond this.
What was their response to that?
They understood and just play the game.
Okay. So, and yeah. How far into the course were you doing significantly, at poorly enough to an extent where people really kind of raised their eyebrows and were like, okay, like, what's wrong?
I don't think they ever really... Because I didn't fail anything. There was no failures.
Mm-hmm.
Just wasn't performing as I normally perform. Way below average of my performance level. So I don't think I raised the red flag by the instructors. It was just more, we talked offline because I brought it up.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so as you got through that, right? You were just kind of going through the motions there, really not caring. But you did have a light at the end of the tunnel, which was your next school, which was what?
Infantry Weapons Officer course.
Okay, so the course that certifies you to be a Marine gunner.
Right.
Your dream.
Yep.
So you had to get through, you know, Warrant Officer Basic course, which is 4 months. And then you report to Infantry Warrant Officer's course.
Correct. Which is in the same location.
Same location.
4 months.
4 months,
yep.
But it's all with guys who want to be Marine gunners.
Right.
Okay. So let's talk about your mindset finishing up, you know, Warrant Officer Basic course and then going to the gunner's course.
Yeah. So I started to, I felt relieved that I got through Warrant Officer Basic course. Still being away from my family was a strain. I think it was a strain for all of us there, right? Because we were all away from families except for like a couple guys. So that was still there, and just like a relief that going into a different, you know, a more course that was at our level. So that was exciting.
So, I mean, at MARSOC, you'd spent plenty of time away from your family.
Right.
Right? Like your operational tempo and the office hours were crazy.
Yeah.
Why do you think it was hitting you so hard to be away from your family at that point?
I think because I was doing a basic school that was behind me, and really, I think, I don't know, I just think things start to come to a head for me now that I look back at it. It's like, what am I doing, and why am I continuing to drive this hard and beat myself up and beat, you know, my family up, like, and... I don't know. It never came out that way. But now that I look back after I got help and everything else, now that I see, like, you know, that's where the cracks start to come. And I just buried them deeper instead of letting them out.
How were you burying them deeper?
I was just suppressing them. Just didn't think about it.
Was that a conscious thing?
No, I think it was subconscious. I just think it was just, you know, I just had to keep driving. Couldn't be a failure. Had to keep going.
Okay. So now shifting into Infantry Warrant Officer's course, Gunner's course.
Yep.
Did you have any time between basic course and then Gunner's course?
1 week.
1 week. Okay. So basically, you're staying in Quantico.
Yeah.
And then you start this course. Now, finally, you're surrounded by infantry guys.
Yep.
Guys who are all at least gunnery sergeants, right? So all are probably combat veterans.
Yes.
There is much more of a like-minded mentality there. A lot of commonalities between careers there. You all probably fought potentially with the same battalions, right?
Yeah.
Especially for, well, maybe not the special operations guys, because you know you were the only one, but all these guys are speaking the same
lingo. Yeah, we all speak the same lingo.
Okay. So let's dive into that. What's that course like?
Very academically strenuous, and it was long. Like, it was a long 4 months. It burns you out. There's work every night, group projects, a lot of traveling to different battle site studies, a lot of guest speakers. It was just very... And then you're training with every single weapon system. You're building training. Things, you know, we've all done, but it's just 4 months of like beating it into you. And, during this time, like every weekend, and including Wobeck, I was driving home back to North Carolina.
Okay.
So you can imagine the pure, exhaustion I was feeling across the board.
Would you liken that to, in the last episode when you talked about your time at MARSOC and how even when you were back in the States, not deployed, you'd come home and you'd just
crash
on a Friday.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You'd be essentially in bed, on a Friday night until Sunday morning.
Right.
Unable to do anything, besides rest and refit for the following week. Would you say it was a similar, experience?
It was. It was definitely a similar experience. And I think, now that I look back, like during this time, like I did not know who Joey was. Like I knew who Gunner Patrico was or Master Sergeant Patrico, but Joey, I did not know that person. Like who was Joey?
So somewhat of a loss of identity.
A loss of identity. The only thing I knew was work.
And would you say that's a continuation of your time in special operations?
Yeah, I think it was a time of just how I was brought up in the Marine Corps. Right, and then it just got significantly worse as I got more senior. Of, you know, who is this? You know, I'm Marine Patrico, not Joey.
So, at what point throughout your career did you become conscious of the fact that you no longer saw yourself as a individual human being? Right, you were just a warfighter, a Marine, a special operator, or a gunner in training?
After my first deployment.
To Iraq. Okay. So 2 years into service.
A year into service.
So, a year.
Yeah, 2006, I came back. 2006 from deployment. After that first deployment, everything started to shift mentality-wise for me. And then it got progressively worse.
How did it get progressively worse?
So, I mean, we talked about it. Like, I was angry, distant. And then, you know, up 2006 until 2015-ish, I was drinking. I stopped drinking in 2015 by myself. But, you know, really just work was everything. That was it. Like, you know, I was this Marine, and I needed to do all these things to take care of the guys, like take care of the dudes, take care of the mission, and I'm going to come last. I don't matter. Everyone in my life doesn't matter. Whatever I have to do to, you know, accomplish the mission.
So, talking about drinking.
Yep.
What was the release that you were looking for by drinking?
I just wanted to forget everything. You know, I just, yeah, drinking was, it helped me not think. It was just, you know, I just went out and partied and got drunk and did stupid things that I just blacked out and nothing mattered. It was just a continuation of pushing everything in my life away that was important and that I needed to actually sit there and listen to people and not be in charge and run the show. And I couldn't handle that. So I drank to get away from reality.
So it was the ultimate reprieve from
life,
which at that point your life was being a leader.
Yeah, my
being
life.
A military leader.
Yep.
Being 100% focused on developing combat troops.
Yep.
Deploying and then executing combat missions.
Yep.
So you turn to drinking to basically pull back from that, forget about it because it was stressing you out.
Yeah.
I mean, we've used the bucket of water analogy, right?
Yeah.
Where it's like you only have so much that you can fill, and then at some point
it's gonna overflow.
It's gotta overflow.
Yep.
So your bucket
was,
you know,
full.
Was full. At what point do you think it became full?
My bucket became full after my first enlistment. But did I realize it? No. No. I just my emptying of the bucket was working. So,
and that would be the drinking that was
yeah,
emptying it.
Yeah. And then just the success and the immediate gratification of work, and seeing, like, yeah, this is my fingerprint on things, and watching guys be successful allowed me to not the bucket to, you know, not completely overflow, even though it was like dripping out.
Okay.
If that makes sense. Yeah.
And so now when you were at Gunner's course,
yeah,
you said you started to crack, or really at one officer's
yeah.
course, right? So, and those cracks were being realized with poor performance, not caring.
Yep.
And you kind of went through the motions to get to the end of that, those 4 months. Then you go to Gunner's course.
Yep.
The material is super hard.
Yep.
You're working your butt off. And how were those cracks being realized to a greater extent at that point? Or where was your mindset at that point? Because now you're in an interesting position, because you're on your way to your dream job.
Yep.
You are working with like-minded people.
Yep.
Who can rationalize with your experience. And in many regards, you are somewhat in a vacuum, which is just infantry intensive work.
Yeah. So my mindset was, I just got to get through this. I have to make up for what I didn't show in Warrant Officer Basic course. And I just got to keep driving and win at this point to get to the end so I could get that dream job. The cracks were definitely there, like anger. I was, you know, I pushed my family away even more. Yeah, at this point, I barely ever see my kids. My wife, I was not emotionally there for her. And just pushing away all my life problems and it just started to get worse and worse and worse.
So, emotionally, would you even say that you had emotions at that time?
No.
Or were you just...
I was just going. Autopilot. Straight.
And was that just a conscious decision? Or?
No, I just think it was completely unconscious. It was just remember the switch I talked about last? The switch was on, and I was going. There was no empathy. There was no understanding of other people. It's just like, hey, I got to do this, and that's it. This is what I'm doing, and I'm going, and I'm driving.
So the switch is on.
Yep.
And you're rolling through Gunner's course.
Yep.
How'd you do at Gunner's course in terms of performance?
I was towards, you know, top of the pack on that.
So you were able to pull your performance
yeah.
around vice the previous course where...
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So as you wrap up Gunner's course, what's next?
So after Gunner's course, I got orders to Victor 2-8, which is Infantry Battalion, which we both know, America's Battalion. Graduated from Infantry Weapons Officer course in September and checked into Victor 2-8 in October, first week of October, and just hit the ground running. barely any break. I think I took like 2 weeks off. I had 4 weeks, but I only took 2 weeks off because I wanted to get going.
That was between Warrant Officer, Gunner's course, and then showing up to an infantry battalion.
Yep.
Now finally realizing your dream being a infantry battalion gunner.
Right. Yep. And I got there and, yeah, hit the ground running, started, you know, working with all the companies, working with the platoons, and just doing the thing, doing the job. And it was, that's my passion, helping people, and being there. And it was good for the first October, November till December. But what I noticed was, you know, I was staying at work way too late.
So you were living in your office?
Yeah, I was living in my office.
7 days a week?
It was like five.
5 days a week, yep. Living in the office, on her famous mattress pad.
That's right.
Working, essentially 24-7.
24-7, yep.
Okay.
And if I went home, I went home, and I would work. I would continue working. Like, my wife, Summer, was, you know, just loving Joey home, right? Because I'm like, yeah, I'll fix our marriage. I'll come home every day. I went home with the computer and had her sit next to me on the couch while I worked on some product.
Okay.
Yeah.
And as you continuously work, you know, are you at any point, are you showing any sort of effects from post-traumatic stress from your combat deployments? At this point, I mean, you had not been diagnosed with a traumatic brain injury, but you did have one, as we later found out.
Yeah, well, TBI, I knew I had, but PTSD, no, I didn't. And did I show signs? At work, no. At home, yes. So people at home knew, like my wife knew, kids knew, family knew, like they knew something was wrong. But at work I was in my zone and I could just go.
Right. Because the switch is on.
The switch is on. That's what it's built for, right? Is work.
Right. So as you go home and you're talking about these signs, what are the behaviors that, were telltale signs of the PTSD, of the TBI?
So isolation was one, a huge one. Anger, no empathy, lack of emotion.
How were you isolating yourself?
Well, that's when I went home and just stayed in a room and slept all weekend. Mm-hmm. Like I was not, you know, I wouldn't communicate. I wouldn't talk. I wouldn't open up. Emotions were not there. Affection wasn't there. Yeah, it was just like I was this shell of a human.
And what about the anger?
I wasn't violent. I just was, you know, like more like aggressive, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah. Like I wasn't never a violent person, like never violent. But I would, you know, see myself going like flipping a switch and losing my mind on something. And that's where, you know, for me to stop that of me losing my mind, I would just lie to avoid issues, right? Lie to create time and space so I can maneuver, and not deal with, you know, conflict, because I didn't know how to deal with conflict. The only thing I knew how to deal with was by losing my shit.
Okay. So in your personal life, you're having the effects of this essentially snowball,
yeah.
Right? Oh, you are working, living at the office at least 5 days a week, to offset that in your personal life. There's a number of lies and anger, which is just growing and growing, yep. And growing.
Yeah.
And at some point, that's probably filling up your bucket, if not overflowing.
Yeah.
Right? So it's getting worse and worse and worse at home. And how are you trying to run away from that? Or is this just how are you trying to empty the bucket?
Just by working. Yeah. So my bucket emptiness was working. That's how I did it. And avoiding issues. So that's what I did. And lie. And tried to create just try to protect myself. And try to protect people in my life from certain things. And avoiding all issues. But that, I mean, like you just said, like that bucket got to the point where I could not, you know, let it drip out anymore. And that all came to a head when my wife, Summer, left me, told me to get out, and she's done. And then didn't see my, ever see my kids. And in that moment, it's like, my bucket's overflowing. Bucket's done.
When did that happen?
So it started happening during Christmas time, and the complete like overflow of the bucket happened December 26th of 2022, when I drove. I was just bawling my eyes out and drove 3 hours away to Princeton, North Carolina, somewhere. Don't know where that is. Didn't even know I was driving that far. Didn't know where I was. And then, like I said before, had a bunch of pills in my car. I was just gonna take them, and you know, go out in this, you know, glory of not knowing what I was doing.
So, at what point, when essentially your whole personal life has fallen apart?
Yep.
You've masked everything.
Yeah, hit everything.
With work, yep. Right? By turning the switch on. Yet everything external to work has just fallen apart.
That's shit.
And you just can't, you are covering things up as they are snowballing, and it's just getting worse and worse and worse. And that all comes to it just comes to a breaking point right around Christmas.
Yeah.
And at the point where you turn to looking at, you know, suicide as the ultimate option.
Yeah.
As the only solution to your problems.
Yeah,
which is something that's very common, right? Within military veterans, as we mentioned.
22.
You know, 22 a day.
Yeah.
Right? You could have been a statistic.
Yeah.
Was that a conscious decision?
I just think I couldn't handle it anymore at that point. I'm going to try not to cry. I didn't see light at the end of the tunnel. I just thought my life was, like you said, like, was a shit show. And I was like, what is after this uniform? Like, what is going to be there? I got nothing. Everything's gone. Everything I love is gone. And I destroyed lives. Not on purpose, but I did. So
you're facing a complete, you know, crisis of identity.
Yep.
As you look into the future.
Yep.
Right? And you think about taking off the uniform, ultimately turning the switch off forever.
Yeah.
Right? There's a lot of questions as to, you know, why? What's next?
Yep.
Right? I have nothing to come back to.
Yep.
I have given 110% to this thing without ever looking back.
Yep.
And now what does, you know, what does this give me on the back end?
Yeah.
So you go away, you drive a couple hours.
Yep.
With the thought of committing suicide, and, you know, you've hit your breaking point.
Yeah, I was broke.
What brought you back from that?
A phone call. My phone rang.
At this point, you are preparing to commit suicide.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of a farm field. Don't ask me how I got there, but I was in the middle of a farm field.
Okay.
I drove there apparently, but don't know how, where.
And you weren't drinking at this point?
No, I don't drink still to this day.
You hadn't drank anything?
Nope.
You were just in such a, as we talked about, Cooper's color code, right? You
black.
Were in the black. You
yep.
were not making conscious decisions. You were at such a level of emotional duress that you are just not having conscious thought.
Yeah, like my heart rate was, I don't know how I didn't have a heart attack. Tunnel vision, literally looking through a tube. If you put a tube up to your eyes, that's what it looked like. You know, pure tunnel vision. I could only see through like a straw. And the only reason I stopped was my phone rang, and I answered the phone.
Who was on the other side of that call?
My friend Daryl was on the other side of the call.
And what was that conversation like?
Oh, I don't remember, to be honest. I just know I was crying. My eyes out. Crying my eyes out, and I'm like, I'm gonna make a phone call. I'm gonna make a phone call to the SOCOM Care Coalition and find a place to go. Because I can't live this way anymore, and I don't wanna lose everything in my life, so at that moment, I hung up with them and called the SOCOM Care Coalition. Was like, I need a place, an inpatient place to go to go away, to get help, because this is not it. Like, I'm not going to go out this way, number one. And number two, I need help. I need to figure this out. And them and 2-8 got me into Laurel Ridge in Texas. And that's where I went for 48 days for inpatient care.
So shortly thereafter, you go to Texas for inpatient care.
Yeah, 24 hours later. Yeah.
24 hours later.
Yeah, got me right there.
You are at a mental hospital.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And this hospital, is it all PTSD, TBI-related injuries? Is it a military hospital? Who is there?
It's sanctioned. I think it's part, like, it's sanctioned by DOD.
Okay.
The Department of Defense. So it was only military personnel or a few veterans. And there's four different units. Unit one being the combat-oriented unit, which I was on. So PTSD, that type of injury. Unit two was military sexual trauma. So any sexual trauma that happened in the military. Unit three was substance abuse, people who were either on drugs or needed help from that. And then unit four was, I don't really know what unit four was, but I'm pretty sure it was like really crazy people. But I don't know off the top of my head because I never really saw Unit 4. So
you show up to this place in Texas.
Oh, yeah.
And what is going through your head?
I'm like, where am I? What am I doing? You know, and I was super, for the first three, I was like, I'm in jail. I'm in a mental hospital and I'm with crazy people, which weren't crazy. They're all great friends now. We all support each other. That's why we call this the tribe. But, yeah, I'm like, what? Whoa, this ain't me. Like, I'm okay. I don't need to be here. And that was the first, like, 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks.
So, as you check in, what's this check-in process like? You walk through the doors to this place.
Yeah, so walk into the doors, fill out a bunch of paperwork, you know, the normal paperwork. And then you get into your unit, and it's like, okay, now we're going to dump all your stuff out. Everything you have with strings, you can't have strings. Let me take your cell phone. Go through like the medical process of like questionnaires, stuff like that. And then like, okay, here's your unit. And then you just, you know, you start to meet people. And the first person that came up to me was Adam. Usually it's Ski, but Adam came up to me and started giving me the rundown. I'm like, all right.
And who is Adam? Is he another patient?
He was a patient, yeah.
Okay. And is he like in a leadership position within the
patient? Yeah, there's no really leadership position. He's just another patient who's been there. You know, usually the guys there the longest take over like internal leadership.
Okay.
And take people under their wings for the tribe. And yeah, he was one of the senior guys there.
So just talking about tribe, what do you mean by that? Let's elaborate that, because obviously that's how we came to name the podcast and really our initiative here.
So the tribe is what we called ourselves at Unit 100. And really it's, you know, if you think about any elite unit or, you know, think of, you know, the Native Americans, they had tribes and they really took care of each other within that tribe. And you lean on, you know, your buddies, you know, to emotionally support you, to vent to give you advice, but that, and that's where really, it's called the tribe, is that's where the healing really came from, was the shared experiences, the ability to talk and understand. So really just, that's why we're calling this the tribe. So we could, you know, this shouldn't just be like a Laurel Ridge Unit 100 thing. This should be like an everyone thing, right? Because it is a family. It is that emotional support network. It is that shared experience to know you're not alone. Like, you know, I got this going on too. So.
And so how many people are in the tribe in Unit 100?
So we maxed out, I think top number there before I left was 28. So 28 people.
28 people. And are they all combat, combat oriented guys? They were all special operators. What was their background?
Yeah, they're across DOD.
Across
the DOD.
All services.
All services, all with combat experience. We're looking at, for that unit, we're looking at time in service average is 15 years.
Okay.
Lowest rank would have been E6, E7.
So very senior guys.
Yeah, very senior. Very senior.
Guys who went out, did the thing.
Did the thing.
Came back, did it again.
Yep. And continue to do it.
And continue to do it.
Yep.
Guys with a lot of leadership experience.
Leadership experience. And, you know, just hit their bucket, got too full. Yeah.
Right. So as you show up, are you... What's the day-to-day rhythm like at this place when you upon entry?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like Groundhog's Day. So I can tell you the schedule. So we go to breakfast, 6:30. It's a very military-like schedule.
Okay.
6:30, go to breakfast, 30 minutes for breakfast. Then you have class on some sort of behavioral health class.
Who's teaching this stuff?
All therapists.
Okay.
All trauma therapists with years of experience who understand the military, understand the lingo, understand what individuals are going through. Very, very good. You see a psychiatrist every day.
And so what are the conversations with the psychiatrist like? And are they prescribing you drugs? Are you taking drugs during
Yes.
that time?
Yeah. So the psychiatrist is very medication oriented. And he's there to talk to you to make sure you're doing, your meds are good, all this stuff. Your therapist is there to pick your brain apart and get down to your darkest, deepest secrets from childhood to everything.
And how often are you seeing the therapist?
Twice a week.
So twice a week, and then the psychiatrist is every day.
Yeah.
Okay. And so as you build your relationship with your therapist.
Yep.
Did you have gates kind of up, or were you an open book upon entry?
No, first my gates were completely up. Completely up, right? Because I needed to build that rapport with her. And yeah, she saw right through those gates and tailored her questions to break every gate I had.
So what are those questions like? You sit down, it is therapy session number one
yeah.
with your therapist. You guys are sitting down. What kind of room are we looking at?
Kind of like, you know.
Is it a small
room.
Okay, so a small room.
Yep.
Just you and her.
Just me and her.
And what does she open up with?
Let me see if I can remember. Just tell me about yourself. Tell me what went on. Tell me about your military career. You know, basic stuff like that. And then it's like, okay. Well, what do you think about that? How does that make you feel? Like, what were you thinking? Okay, let's go back to this. Like, how did that affect you? And then why? Okay, and this went on for like 2 hours, 2.5 hours, the first session. It's like, okay, I want you to write out your whole military timeline and every event that was significant in your every deployment. I'm like, every deployment, like 6 deployments? And she's like, yes. So I wrote a notebook full of all the significant events in 6 deployments, like wrote it out.
And what classified a significant event in your mind space?
So I put every firefight, every time someone died, every time I did something, stuff like that.
Okay. And was that all very prevalent in your mind at that time? Like, are those easy memories for you to
put out? No, I had to really go back and think about it. It took me about a week to write.
And what's your emotional state as you're going back and thinking through that stuff?
I mean, I cried a lot. It's just a whirlwind, right? And then you start going back like how... I mean, when you're writing that out and you go over your timeline, then it's like... You go back into therapy and it's like digging deeper, right? Like, so what happened here when you were a child? Why do you think you work so much? Like, why do you think you're striving for, like, perfection all the time? So it goes deeper than just deployment stuff.
And were there any common themes that arose?
For me personally, yeah. Low self-esteem issues as a kid. Right, because I'm short, and I always had to feel like I had to always try to win my parents, you're doing a good job, which they never gave me. So I continued that as an adult. So that was one driving factor of me always striving to, like, be the best, go to the next level, is from when I was a kid, of not getting the emotional support I needed from my parents of, you're doing a good job. Parents were great parents. They were just raised Italian and super hard. And that's how I was raised, you know, fight harder, get better.
So the need for the affirmation, which you never received as a child,
was huge.
Triggered this mindset, yep, where you needed to succeed
no matter what,
and get external validation because you weren't getting it internally,
right,
from your family construct as a kid,
right?
And then the military was just a vehicle for that.
Yeah, they just fed it. Yeah.
And I mean, I think what's interesting about the military too is that it's a place where you do get good jobs, you do get promotions.
Oh, yeah.
It's very showy in some matters, right? I mean, whenever you're wearing a uniform, like, you're wearing your career
on your chest. Yep.
And everyone can see the awards that you've received, the deployments that you've been on, so on and so forth. So it's very interesting that ties. That paired up.
Yeah.
That definitely coupled.
Yeah.
Very,
crazy.
Very efficiently.
Yeah.
So you're in your first therapy session. Your gates are still up. You are still pretty resistant, but you're now starting to dig deeper.
Yeah.
What's session number two like?
I mean, session number two was, okay, now we're going to now that I had my deployment timeline, we're going to record your triggering event. Like, what was the event that gives you the most trouble? So I had to tell the story of my first deployment, of what gave me the most trauma, and that was buried, and she drove the conversation, and I told the story.
Got
and
it.
Recorded. It was recorded. Like, my voice recorded.
So were all the sessions recorded?
No, just that. This is my triggering event, and I had to listen to it every day.
Okay. Gunner, we're going to hop into that on the next episode.
Okay.
Again, appreciate your time. Appreciate all the effort that you're putting into the Tribe Podcast. And, you know, as we go through this mission together, I hope we can, you know, make the lives of veterans and service members alike better. And ultimately, our mission is, right, to normalize mental health by creating an open narrative for our people's protectors, one conversation at a time,
yeah,
and lower the number of 22 veteran suicides every day.
Yeah, absolutely. Raise that awareness.
Awesome. Thanks again, man.
Yeah, thanks, brother.